Alive by Sharon Bolton. Read by Natalie Buscombe. Chapter 1. Susan. A dark moon is rising. A perfect black circle, barely visible in the night sky. The dark moon casts its void over the wind-scorched moor, over the soaring mass of a great limestone hill, and over the town that cowers in its shadow. The dark moon is the absence of moon before the slender silver crescent of the new moon appears again, and people can breathe a little easier. The month is March, and the night is clear and cold, black as pitch. The full moon in March is known as the Worm Moon, welcome despite its ominous name, marking as it does the end of winter and the emergence of earthworms from the thawing ground. Dark moons have never been named, although they are sometimes called the dead moons. The dark moons reign over nights when people stoke up their fires, draw their curtains tighter, and try to think happy thoughts. In the town of Sabden, at the foot of Pendle Hill in Lancashire, they usually fail. In Sabden's soot-blackened terraced houses, the sleepers' dreams darken when the moon leaves the sky. Infants wake up cold, mothers tremble with elusive fears for their children, and old folks slip a little closer to death. Even the town's witches are afraid, casting salt circles round their homes for protection and burning sage leaves to ward off evil spirits. Only the craftsman welcomes the dark moon. When the town is at its most still, when the only creature astir is the dog that stalks the railway arch tramps in the refusal to believe he is an unloved stray, the craftsman roams, ever watchful. He walks the silent streets, keeping always to the shadows. He avoids soft ground where he might leave footprints, but a window without drawn curtains is irresistible to him. He does not linger, but his footsteps might slow a little as he passes down the length of Springfield Street, because it is here, at number 17, that Susan lives. Monday, 17th of March, 1969. Susan Duxbury was unique among her class of 14 and 15-year-olds because she liked Mondays. Loved them, in fact. Susan got up early on Mondays to get to the bathroom before the rest of the family and, in cold water, because it was never hot first thing in the morning, washed her fringe and the front 2 inches of her long, dark brown hair. Susan had greasy hair that needed washing every day, but bath times were once a week in the Duxbury household, and Susan's night was Friday. She didn't have time to wash her entire head of hair, but the couple of inches closest to her face made a difference. When that front strip of hair was clean, she washed her face, underarms, feet, and between her legs, and squeezed a fresh spot that had appeared on her chin overnight. Satisfied at last, she crept back along the thin upstairs carpet to the room she shared with her older and younger sisters. Apart from a pale light creeping in from the street lamps outside, the room was in darkness, but Susan could see Stella wriggling and stretching beneath her blankets as she dressed in bed. Most mornings in winter, Susan did that too, but not on Mondays. Mondays were too important. Bracing herself against the cold, she pulled off her nightdress and tugged on her school uniform. She definitely had lost weight since, well, since it had happened. Her skirt was inches looser than it had been. When she heard her mother go downstairs to light the kitchen fire, she ran along the corridor to her parents' room. Dad was never an alert presence in the house at breakfast time. If he wasn't at work or asleep, it meant he was in prison. And so Susan was free to dab foundation on the worst of her spots and perfume on her wrists. Makeup wasn't allowed at school, but foundation didn't count. Foundation was invisible. By the time the family of six were gathered round the kitchen table, the 8 o'clock news on the radio was predicting severe storms around the Orkney Islands in Scotland, with several vessels already believed to be in danger. As the newsreader moved on to a story about the Cray twins beginning their life sentences for murder, Susan was polishing off her cornflakes and blowing on her tea to cool it. Susan was always first to leave the house, on Mondays. As she ran through St. Giles's churchyard, a shortcut, though a bit spooky on these dark mornings, she was surprised to see the town sexton hard at work, but the long winter had killed off a lot of the old folk. Susan giggled at the thought of a queue of corpses lining up for their funerals, because she was young, and death was something that happened to other people. She took a detour when she was in sight of the school building, so that she could skirt round the car park. Sometimes they arrived at the same time, and she got to say, "Morning, sir," before anyone else in the whole school. It was her punctuality that had made him notice her, he told her. That and her long, sweet-smelling dark hair. And her gorgeous, gorgeous bum. No one had ever said nice things to Susan before. Not her family, and certainly not the boys at school, who called her lardy arse and dozy cow. What did they know? She slowed her pace, slipping with practiced ease into her film star walk, taking small, deliberate steps and letting her hips swing. Too late. The red Hillman Hunter, the nicest car in the teacher's car park, was there already, parked next to the empty milk bottle crates. One day, he'd promised her, she'd get to ride in that car. The pang of disappointment at not seeing him left her soon. It was Monday, after all. Last period was geography, her favourite. David Milner, who taught geography at Sabden Secondary Modern, got home shortly after 4 o'clock and made himself a sandwich of Mother's Pride bread and seedless raspberry jam. As he stuffed the food into his mouth, he wondered if he'd made the bed that morning and decided he didn't care. He should probably draw the curtains, though, if only so he didn't have to look at her face. With a bit of luck, she wouldn't want to kiss him again, because just the thought of that acne-ridden mush reeking bad breath was enough to make him gag. He reminded himself that he chose the ugly ones for a reason. The ugly ones were grateful. The ugly ones believed you were in love, that there was a future, and that the secrecy would only be for a short time. The ugly ones were less likely to be believed if they ever decided to tell. Duxbury might be the ugliest he'd had in years, but her father had been in prison more times than anyone could remember, and her mother was barely articulate. As long as he didn't get her pregnant, he could keep this going for months. And with the curtains drawn, taken from behind, at least he wouldn't have to worry about her face. His erection was rubbing against his trousers. "Down, boy," he muttered, giving it an encouraging rub as he glanced at the clock on the mantelpiece. The bitch was actually late. Susan left school at 4:15, a quarter of an hour after lessons had finished for the day, but she hadn't wanted to get trapped into walking home with any of the other girls. Besides, David was always so good about giving her the excuse she needed, asking her to tidy the classroom or, as he'd done that day, sending her with a note to one of the other teachers. David. Maybe today she'd ask him if she could call him David. It felt a bit weird, to be honest, calling him Mr. Milner when he was... She hurried down Union Street and past the police station. On the corner of Market Street, she saw the new policewoman, the first female constable in Lancashire, according to the local paper. Her name was Flora, or Fiona, or Florence. That was it. The girls at school had been talking about how weird it would be to be named after a character in the Magic Roundabout, and how none of them could decide whether the policewoman was attractive or not. Most of the girls agreed that they hated ginger hair and freckles and wouldn't be able to stand wearing a thick black police officer's uniform. Susan hadn't argued, but could they not see that Florence's skin was pale but perfect? That her hair shone a rich red gold and her eyes were wide and blue as cornflowers. Even in her ugly flat shoes, she walked with a dancer's grace, and her voice was clear and sweet, high-pitched and clipped in a way that made Susan think of TV stars or real-life princesses. Florence was talking to a tall, dark-haired man whom Susan thought was also a police officer, though he didn't wear uniform. He was good-looking too, and he was staring at Florence as they spoke. A wave of doubt rushed through Susan as she realized that David had never looked at her the way the dark-haired police officer was looking at Florence. Susan kept her head down as she hurried past. There was no reason why they'd stop her. No reason at all. Lots of kids come home from school this way. But sometimes she felt as though her secret were bursting out of her, and someone else, a police officer maybe, would be sure to see it. Technically, she was too young to have sex, but as Mr. Milner, David, explained to her, that was just in their culture. In other countries around the world, girls got married when they were 14, even younger.
"I can't marry you till you're 16, he'd said, though we should probably leave it until you've left school completely. Bright girl like you, you could go to college.
Susan loved that he knew she was bright. None of the other teachers could spot that. She glanced in a shop window to see back along the street. The two police officers were still engrossed in their conversation. They hadn't even seen her. Not far now. She'd go in the back way, as she always did, through the ginnel, ducking beneath any washing that had been hung out, until she reached his yard door. He'd be waiting in the kitchen. He always took her straight up to his bedroom. 4 more streets to cross, 3 more, then... Oh God, no. Some kids she knew from school, actually in her class, were coming towards her. They'd ask her where she was going, and she could never think up excuses on the spot. She had a quiet, steady intelligence. That's what David had told her. She needed time to be clever. On an impulse, she turned up the street she was crossing. It ran parallel to David's, so she could approach his house from the top of the ginnel instead. As Susan hurried up the street, out of breath because the road was steep, a van drew up alongside. The driver, a man she knew, wound down the window. Susan slowed her steps a little.
"You're right, love."
The driver looked her up and down.
"You look a bit hot and bothered."
It was Mr. Glassbrook, the dad of one of her school friends. He was the town undertaker, but he never seemed creepy. He actually looked a bit like Elvis Presley, with his slicked back black hair and his smart, colourful jackets. "I'm all right, thanks," Susan said. "I'm just going to my friend's." She had a moment of dread that he'd ask her which friend. She had no idea who lived at the top of this street. He didn't, though. Instead, he said,
"Hop in, love. I'll give you a lift to the top."
Susan's family didn't get concerned until it was nearly 6 o'clock. She was never home from school before 5:30 on Monday because she helped tidy up the geography class and then went to a friend's house to do homework. By 6:30, Susan's mother was starting to wonder if she should have asked which friend. The police began looking for Susan shortly before 8 o'clock. They phoned the neighbouring force to request assistance from the dog unit and diverted all available officers to the house-to-house search. They looked all night. They were wasting their time. Susan was with the craftsman. 16 hours after she was abducted, she was dead. When he realized that the living, kicking, screaming girl had become a lifeless corpse, the craftsman got up from where he had been lying on the hard, frost-glazed earth. He threw back his head and tossed a soundless howl to the absent moon. After a while, when the threat of rage had subsided, he went home to check on the date of the next dark moon. Chapter 2. Stephen. The April full moon comes early in 1969, glowing over the landscape on the second day of the month, when frosted windows still greet the townsfolk of Sabden at daybreak, and when the cold fog hangs low over rooftops as night falls. The full moon in April is known as the pink moon, after the blooming of the ground phlox, which covers the land in a blanket of small pink flowers. Phlox has never bloomed wild in Lancashire, and when the witches gather high above the town, the moors are still the dull browns and dried yellows of winter. In April, the craftsman knows that the long nights are drawing to an end.
A whole winter has gone by, and he has yet to achieve his purpose. He knows his work will be so much harder in the summer, when the evenings are light and the people of the town linger outdoors. In summer, his ability to move around unseen will be lessened. For the first 2 weeks of April, as the dark moon draws closer, the craftsman grows anxious. He has had a second child in his sights for some time now. He knows the child's movements and routines, his friends and his habits, better than do the boy's own parents. But so much, so very much, depends on chance. Wednesday, 16th of April, 1969. Stephen Shorrock was playing football on a patch of spare land three streets from where he lived when his mate Jimmy ran up, red-faced and panting. "Oi, lads," he called. "That dwarf freak is in St. Andrews. He's digging." The boys looked towards Stephen. Knowing they would take their lead from him, he thought about it. His side was winning, but the dwarf freak was the sexton, the man who held a grim fascination for the town's children. It wasn't just that he was shorter than most of them, with an odd, inharmonious body and a great protruding brow. More that he buried the dead and must have seen more corpses than they'd watched episodes of Blue Peter. They liked to watch him work. They liked to stop him working. They liked to bait him from afar, the way their ancestors might have poked sticks into a tethered bear. Because when the sexton became riled, his temper bore no relation at all to his diminutive size. And he was dangerous. The games wouldn't be half as much fun if he weren't. "Let's do it," Stephen said. The six lads, all 14 and 15 years old, from the same school in Sabden, left the spare land, scooping up school sweaters that had served as goalposts and calling schoolboy insults to each other to disguise their nerves. Roger brought his football, clutched tight to his chest like a shield. They ran, panting, up the hill and round the corner. At the top of Gillibrand Street, they paused, because Danny Earnshaw, son of the chairman of the town council, was riding a new bike. It was a rally chopper, a revolutionary design that had been launched just 2 weeks earlier. The boys had seen coverage on the nightly news, had never imagined they'd see one in Sabden quite so soon. They stared, but Danny Earnshaw was with his gang, and you didn't mess with that lot if you were wise. The boys carried on running, under the fencing, across the railway line and down into the street behind St. Andrew's Church. Stephen gestured that they should take cover behind the church wall while he scoped out the scene. The boys dropped to the ground, panting, and Stephen raised his head. Dwayne Ogilvy, a man of around 27, although to the children he appeared as old as Methuselah, was standing in the grave, in shirt sleeves, his hairline damp with sweat. He was working with a spade, bending and digging before tossing the earth into a long, rectangular box lying alongside. Round the edge of the hole, Dwayne had placed a wooden template, a guide to make sure the grave was perfect. A rectangular piece of plywood lay a little distance away, and on it, Dwayne had placed the turf he'd removed from the ground, arranging the pieces like a jigsaw puzzle so that they could be replaced neatly on the finished grave. On the ground were several more spades, some heavy-duty knives, and a pick. Dwayne might be only a digger of graves, but he did the job well. For the first time, Stephen found himself feeling a grudging respect for the dwarf. For a second, he was tempted to change his mind. But then he saw the faces of his mates and knew he'd never hear the end of it. "Jimmy, Craig, go round that side." Stephen pointed to the wall opposite. "Rog, Duffy, that way." He pointed to the corner. "Sug stays with me." The four boys hurried away and took their places around the wall. Stephen waited until Dwayne was looking down before directing an urgent finger at Rog and Duffy. They were ready. They popped up like meerkats and hurled stones at Dwayne's back. Rog was the better shot. His stone landed in the grave beside the sexton. Duffy's fell short by several feet. Dwayne stopped what he was doing and spun round. Rog and Duffy had already ducked low. Stephen watched as the little man frowned and waited for a long minute before turning back to his job. Exactly as Stephen had expected, though, Dwayne shifted his position around so that he was facing the wall where Rog and Duffy were hiding. Stephen waited for 5 more spades of earth to land in the box before he directed his finger at Jimmy and Craig. They appeared, threw their stones, and ducked. These 2 were better shots. One stone landed in the grave, the other caught Dwayne on the arm.
"Who's there?"
The dwarf whirled round and his normally sallow colour had turned pink.
"Pack it in or I'll have you."
The boys didn't answer. Of course they didn't. This was far too much fun. And after a minute or 2, Dwayne resumed his work. He was on his guard now, though, glancing up every few seconds. That was fine. That was how it was supposed to work. His heart beating fast, Stephen gave the signal, a different one this time, to Rog and Duffy. They stood and threw. Neither stone hit its mark, but Dwayne heard them fall. He looked up, saw the 2 boys, and leaped out of the grave. Rog and Duffy set off running. They were the 2 fastest of the group and had been chosen specially for this job, because Dwayne might have short legs, but he could run fast. He raced across the uneven grass towards the 2 boys and vaulted over the churchyard wall to give chase. As Dwayne left the churchyard, Stephen and Suggs climbed into it. Making sure Dwayne was nowhere in sight, they ran to the grave. Jimmy and Craig arrived a second later. Grinning, the 4 boys took hold of the box of earth and lifted it. It was heavy, but they managed to tilt it just far enough for the earth it contained to start trickling back into the grave. As the box lightened, the boys could push it further, and more earth fell. By the time they heard the yell of outrage from the churchyard gate, the box was almost empty.
"Run!"
yelled Suggs, which he shouldn't have done. Only Stephen was supposed to give orders, but the others were so keyed up by this stage they didn't notice. They set off, letting the box fall. Stephen followed a second behind, hearing the pounding footsteps of the sexton drawing closer. The others reached the wall and clambered over. Stephen was about to bound up after them when his left foot landed in a rabbit hole. It threw him off balance. He stumbled, went down on one knee, and Dwayne had him. The small man was incredibly strong. He dragged Stephen to his feet, holding him by his shirt collar and pulling him back towards the grave. When they reached its edge, he dangled Stephen above it.
"How about I drop you in?"
he yelled into the frightened boy's face. The grave was hardly a hole at all, now that the earth had been returned to it, but Stephen didn't feel inclined to point this out.
"Sorry," he stammered. "Only a joke. My dad'll have you if you hurt me."
"Don't fancy a grave, do you?"
Dwayne leaned further, until Stephen thought gravity must surely step in and say,
"Enough's enough, you 2 are going in."
"Don't think you'd enjoy being left underground for the worms to eat, eh?"
Dwayne shook him. "Any second now," thought Stephen. "I'm going, and he's going to land on top of me."
No,
he stammered, wondering if he should use the dad threat again. His dad would probably wallop him for throwing stones near a church. Dwayne appeared to make a decision. He turned away from the grave and, dragging Stephen with him, made for the church. When they reached it, he stopped, considered, and then lifted Stephen bodily. Stephen was yelling loudly by this time, but Dwayne took no notice. Stephen felt himself being pinned against the stone with one hand while the other fiddled with his clothes. Then he heard his shirt tearing and felt something cold and hard pressing against the bare skin of his back. Dwayne let him go, but instead of falling to the ground, Stephen found himself hanging in midair. The neck of his shirt and anorak felt very tight around his throat.
"Can you breathe?"
Dwayne asked him.
"Let me down," Stephen yelled. "You lot, get help!"
There was no answer. His friends had fled.
"Pity,"
Dwayne said, before turning back to the grave. Stephen hung from the stone gargoyle for 30 minutes before he remembered that he could unzip his anorak. The buttons on his shirt held him for another 5 before they broke and he fell to the ground. Dwayne didn't even stop digging as Stephen picked himself up and ran. His mum would kill him for ripping his shirt. His eyes were full of tears, so he didn't see the man on the pavement, just outside the church gate, until he was grabbed, a second time that hour, by the collar of his shirt.
"Hold on, young fella, where do you think you're going?"
Stephen ran a sleeve over his eyes and squirmed to face the man holding him. His dad's age, maybe a few years older, but with short, sandy hair. He wore a smart suit, but he smelled the way his dad did when he came back from the pub.
"None of your bloody business, get off me, pervert!"
Stephen pulled at the hand that gripped his collar. He was silenced by a short slap on his left cheek.
"Less of your lip, answer me."
Stephen was more outraged than hurt. Parents could hit you, and teachers. That was only to be expected. Not strangers in the street, even if they were wearing fancy suits and driving posh cars. Somehow he just knew the dark blue Rover P6 parked at the side of the road belonged to this man.
"You can't touch me. I'll have the bloody police on you."
The man slapped him again.
"Well, that's where you're wrong, sonny. I am the police. Now, why don't you come with me and we'll have a little chat?"
Stephen's friends went back for him, eventually. But the churchyard at St. Andrew's was deserted. A tarpaulin had been stretched across the open grave, hammered into the ground with tent pegs at four corners. The box of earth had been pushed a little further from the grave, and on top of it lay the sheet of plywood and the removed turf. The sun was getting lower in the sky by this time, and the boys knew their parents would be wondering where they were. Late arrival home invariably spelled trouble, and none of them was inclined to risk a backhander. Also, they were all hungry.
"He's gone home," said Suggs.
"What if that dwarf's taken him?" said Roger.
"Not we can do. My mam'll leather me if I'm late again," said Jimmy.
"He's in that grave."
Craig, out of all of them, was the most inclined towards the dramatic. The five boys stared over the wall at the tarpaulin, which was old and weathered from 100 or more rainstorms. It sagged in the middle. As they watched, it seemed to billow a little, as though someone were blowing it from below.
"Do you think Danny Earnshaw will let us have a go on his chopper?" Jimmy said.
"That psycho'll chop your dick off for asking," Suggs told him.
"That dwarf's a psycho," said Craig. "He's killed Steve and left him in that grave." "I'm going home," said Jimmy. He didn't move.
"We have to check," said Duffy.
He'd been a prefect at school, briefly, before he'd had his badge taken away for keeping a ferret in his desk.
"Remember that girl who disappeared a few weeks ago? They still haven't found her."
"The fat one," Suggs said.
"Yeah, Susan Duxbury," said Craig. "She was in my class, couldn't stand her." "We can't leave Stephen," Duffy insisted.
"I'm not looking in a grave," said Jimmy.
"I'll do it," said Duffy. "Keep an eye out."
Duffy swung himself over the wall and set off towards the grave. After a few paces, he was joined by Roger and Suggs. The three boys approached the tarpaulin cautiously.
"Steve,"
said Duffy, in a tremulous voice that he was instantly ashamed of. No reply from the grave. Duffy said,
"We have to unpeg it and look underneath."
Neither of the boys argued. Neither moved.
"Get on with it,"
called Jimmy, brave behind the wall. As though by unspoken agreement, the three boys stepped to three corners of the grave. "It only needs one," pointed out Suggs. None of the boys moved to become the one.
"Steve,"
called Suggs sharply. No reply. Duffy crouched down and grasped the tent peg closest to him. He looked at Roger, who did the same.
"Both at once," he said.
The two boys pulled up the pegs and lifted the tarpaulin. Suggs cried out, but with tension, not the shock of discovery. The grave was empty. Of course it was empty. Stephen was destined for another grave entirely, one that might never be discovered. But even carefully laid plans can go wrong. 12 hours after his disappearance, Stephen was dead. When he realised the boy was never going to wake up and plead for mercy again, the craftsman wasn't sure he could contain his fury. He lay flat on the rain-soaked earth, oblivious to the chill soaking his clothes, and he screamed loud enough to be heard in hell. When he finally got to his feet, he was conscious of a sense of despair. Summer was a smile and a song away. His last chance might have gone. Chapter 3. Patsy. A dark moon is rising. The craftsman knows his time is coming round at last. He can feel it in the hot, smoke particle-filled air, smell it on the wind, see its portents in the glimmering night sky. The month is June, and the weathermen are predicting an unprecedented heatwave in the northwest of England, one that will cause tarmac to blister on the roads and pregnant women to faint on factory floors. By the time of the full moon, known traditionally as the strawberry moon, on the last but one day, the local authority will be talking about drought and water rationing and whether standpipes will be necessary on street corners. All that is to come, though, and as the old moon wanes and vanishes, the weather is cold and cloudy. The days are damp, the nights thick with cloud, so that when the dead moon rises in the middle of the month, few are aware of it. At least, not consciously aware. The more sensitive types perhaps get the shivers a little more than usual. "Someone just walked over my grave," they joke, to ward off the vague sense of unease that is creeping over them. The dead moons that go unnoticed are sometimes the most dangerous of all. The second Saturday in June is dull and overcast, a low layer of cloud obscuring the sky. The craftsman spends all day and evening watching for his chance. It doesn't come. On Sunday, he knows it is now or never. Sunday, 15th of June, 1969. In spite of its arboreal-sounding name, the Pendle Forest in Lancashire has never been densely wooded. The land is too high, the winds too strong, the hills too exposed for trees of any size to thrive. Sunnyhurst Park was one of the very few exceptions. Determined Victorians put acorns, conkers, and beechnuts into the ground, and, on a whim perhaps, the tough clay soil chose to indulge them. It sent up shoots, the rains poured down to feed them, and the winds decided to go easy. In 1969, the trees of Sunnyhurst Park had reached their full maturity, and the wide, walled area was tenebrous, thickly wooded, and dark. Possibly because they were so unused to trees and the claustrophobic feel of forests, the people of Sabden avoided the park, so that by the time the end of the 1960s came around, few people came here but older children, and their games weren't always wholesome. It was said that most of the town's teenage pregnancies began in Sunnyhurst Park, and quite a few ended here too, with newborn infants being left to the vagaries of the cold and the wild animals. It was said that the kiosk, the cramped, thatched cottage at the heart of the park that served weak tea, cold coffee and stale cakes to the few who had money to pay for them, had traditionally been the home of witches, that cats had been bricked up alive in its stone walls, and that the rune-like markings along the stone lintel of the front door were a vain attempt to keep out evil spirits. Some said they were there to welcome evil spirits. It was also said that the nearby bandstand hadn't heard music played in decades, other than the drumbeats of the devil worshippers who met at midnight to celebrate the Black Mass. 14-year-old Patsy Wood had hated Sunnyhurst Park since the day she'd been lost in it as a toddler. Her mother swore it was for less than 10 minutes, but in Patsy's young mind, she'd been abandoned in the scariest place imaginable. Ordinarily, nothing would have tempted Patsy to be alone in Sunnyhurst Park, especially at the Daylight Gate, the Lancashire name for the twilight. But John, Luna, and Tammy had asked her to come with them, and every child in the fourth form wanted to be in their gang. Of course she'd agreed. They hadn't mentioned they wanted to play hide-and-seek. They hadn't warned her that she'd have to leave the gang and hide by herself in the middle of the woods. She'd been lying in a sort of cave formed by two fallen trees for what felt like ages. She didn't own a watch, but it seemed like a long time since she'd heard any of the others. They'd left her. No sooner had the thought occurred than it was impossible to shut it out. It had all been a trick. They'd sneaked out of the park and were halfway home by now, or they were hiding in the street to see how long it took before she realised. Patsy could almost hear the sniggers as she walked past their hiding place and the jeers of her classmates the next day. Her face started to glow, sweat breaking out between her shoulder blades. She moved to push herself up and heard something. Hoping the beating of her heart wouldn't be audible, she lay still and listened. Footsteps, slow and soft. Someone creeping up on her. Hope burned for a second before she realised the footsteps were heavy, the steps of an adult. Every dark story Patsy had heard about the park came flooding back as she shrank even further beneath the trees. She wanted to close her eyes and didn't quite dare. Then she saw the boots. A large size, man's boots, old and scuffed, heading her way. She watched, transfixed, until they moved out of her sightline. The sound ceased at the same time, and Patsy froze in horror. Where had he gone? She had a sudden vision of being pulled from her hiding place by her ankles. For the first time, she thought of Susan Duxbury and Stephen Shorrock, two kids from her year at school who'd vanished in recent months. They'd been nowhere near the park, but she squealed as a face appeared not 2 feet from her own.
Caught you, said John Donnelly, the gang leader, who of course wore boots as big as an adult's. She should have thought of that. Budge up, he urged.
He was crawling in beside her. The space beneath the fallen trunks was barely wide enough for the two of them. She could smell his skin, his hair. His face reached level with hers, and he grinned at her.
You're not it, she managed.
Dale Atherton, another gang member, was it.
I know, shush.
He put a finger on her lips and pointed. In the distance, she could just about see Dale, strolling through the trees. He was armed with a stick and was thrashing it against trees, poking it into undergrowth. She watched until he moved out of sight and then turned to the boy at her side. John's arm was around her. How had that happened? They were lying face to face, like lovers. She could smell his sweat and the trace of shampoo on his hair.
You ever been with someone?
He whispered, and she realised his fingers were gently pulling at her dress, inching it up. She could feel the cool air on her bare thighs as the cotton fabric slid upwards.
Why do you want to know?
She tried to sound bored, but darts of excitement were shooting into her groin. John was the best-looking boy in the year. Everyone knew that.
Want to go with me?
His fingers continued their pull and slide. They touched her bare skin and felt like ice. Patsy had no idea what to say. Did he mean now? Would he just pull down her knickers and shove it in her? She didn't want that, did she? She wanted him to kiss her. Yes, definitely. Kiss her first, and then they'd see.
I thought you were going with Luna, she managed.
Just a friend, he said. Not really my type. Want to meet up later?
Where?
Even as she said it, she knew her mother would never give her permission. She'd be in trouble already for not telling her where she was going.
I know a place, John said.
His fingers were stroking the curve of her bum now. They were on top of the cotton of her knickers, but Patsy was shocked by how much she wanted him to slip them inside and touch her bare skin again.
Okay, she said.
I'll have to walk Luna home. I promised her mum. But then I can meet you at the bottom of Snape Street.
No, she really couldn't. My mum will kill me.
I'll look after you.
His hand left her bum then,
and came up to cut the back of her neck. His head moved forward and his lips, warm and wet, were pressing against hers. She only remembered that you were supposed to open your mouth to kiss when he broke away.
Dale's never going to find us. I'll see you later.
He wriggled out, leaving her breathless. Before he disappeared, he bent down to face her.
I really like you, Patsy,
he said, turning and running away. The children walked home together, John and Luna leading the way, his arm around her shoulders. Patsy could almost think she'd imagined the scene beneath the fallen trees, but once, when Luna turned to say something to Tammy, John looked directly at Patsy and gave her a quiet, secret smile.
I really like you, Patsy.
At the corner of Argyle Street, the children went their separate ways.
Bye, Patsy, said Luna, barely giving her a glance. See you tomorrow.
See you, said John. Not see you tomorrow. See you.
Patsy carried on alone, past the corner shop and the White Lion pub, the bookmakers and the hairdressers. Just before she turned into the ginnel that ran between her street and the one adjacent, she took one look towards John and Luna, but they'd gone. In the ginnel, she ducked beneath a bedsheet that had been hanging out to dry in the evening air, then another one, and another, until she was at her own house. The door to the backyard was open.
At you, Pats,
said a voice from the outdoor lavvy, her mum.
Yeah,
Patsy replied, her heart sinking.
I'm popping round to Janet's,
her mum said in a strained voice.
Can you get yourself to bed?
Yeah, I suppose.
See you in the morning, love,
her mother said.
Yes, yes, yes. Her mum was going out.
She wouldn't know that Patsy wasn't upstairs. By the time she got back, Patsy would have returned anyway. She let the yard door close quietly and made her way down the ginnel, away from the house, towards Snape Street. A nearby church clock began to strike as she drew close. 9 o'clock. There was an hour of daylight left at most, and even with John for company, Patsy didn't think she wanted to be out after dark. Not in Sabden. Not while kids were disappearing. She turned the corner and froze. There were too many people in the street. Two cars had just pulled up outside the Eagle and Child pub, and people, colourfully dressed and noisy, were getting out. These were the Sabden Library Players, the local amateur dramatics group. Patsy's nan took her to see every production they did. There was the town librarian, a fat, middle-aged woman who, rumour had it, was both a lesbian and an actual real witch, and a taller, thinner woman who was the solicitor that had represented Uncle Harry when he'd had his trouble. Mr. Greenwood was with them too. He was the town undertaker and worked with Luna's dad at Glassbrook and Greenwood funeral directors. And Mr. Milner, the geography teacher from school. They could not see her. They'd want to know what she was doing out. They might even insist on taking her home. Patsy stepped back behind the corner until the noise of their arrival had subsided. When she risked looking back, the street was empty again, but there was no sign of John. The pub door opened. Patsy dived back. It was no good. The pub was just too busy. She thought quickly. There was a ginnel that ran between Snape Street and Perry Street, the next road along. Most people avoided it, because men who'd had too much beer used it as a urinal, but she was desperate. She turned and strode to the top of the ginnel. No washing in this one. People didn't hang washing in the Snape Street ginnel. The walls on either side were high and built of assorted dirty bricks. Some of them had been painted, but the paint was defiled by obscenities and football graffiti. The blackened doorways stood like missing teeth in a rotting mouth. Bins lined the way, and the central drain was choked with rubbish. Building material lay abandoned outside a yard halfway down, and the cobbles looked greasy and treacherous. Patsy was starting to think this was a bad idea. On the other hand, it would get her to the bottom of Snape Street without being seen. Holding her breath, as much from nerves as to fend off the smell, she stepped into the alley and quickened her pace. A quarter of the way down, it occurred to her that she might actually be hurrying towards danger rather than away from it. As she neared the halfway point, she knew she was committed. Her breath gave out. She took another, as foul as she'd expected, and prepared to sprint to the end. Directly in front of her, a yard door opened, and a man stepped out into the ginnel. As startled as she was, she felt an overwhelming sense of relief that this was someone she knew. Instead of turning and running back, she opened her mouth to explain herself. That was her last mistake. 19 hours after her abduction, Patsy awoke and started to scream. To the craftsman, keeping his lonely vigil close by, no sound could ever have been sweeter. She was alive. The craftsman smiled. Now he could get to work. You have been listening to an Orion audiobook, Alive by Sharon Bolton, read by Natalie Buscombe. Produced by Veronica Gardner for Strathmore Studios, Clerkenwell, London. The text is copyright 2018 Sharon Bolton. The recording is copyright 2018 by Orion Publishing Group Limited. For information about other Orion audiobooks, visit the website at orionbooks.co.uk. If you enjoyed Alive, then discover Sharon Bolton's latest sinister psychological thriller, The Craftsman. You can also visit Sharon's website at sharonbolton.com.